Hello and welcome to Talking Aussie Books, a new weekly podcast shining a spotlight on Australian fiction. My name is Claudine Tennellis. As a writer and avid reader, I love chatting about books. And in this podcast, I'll chat to authors, publishers and readers, giving you, dear listener, insight into what's hot on the Australian fiction scene. So if you're looking for your next book recommendation or just want to know more about Aussie fiction writers, this podcast is for you. Grab yourself a cuppa, sit back and enjoy. Margaret Hickey is an award-winning author and playwright with a PhD in creative writing, specialising in depictions of landscape in Australian literature, work which was nominated for the Nancy Millis Award for Excellence in Thesis Writing. Her new novel, Cutter's End, was recently published by Penguin Random House, a deeply atmospheric, mesmerising crime novel that explores the chilling underbelly of the Australian outback in a story that has echoes of Jane Harper's The Dry and Chris Hammer's Scrublands. A highly entertaining, addictive page-turner. And I'm delighted to welcome Margaret to the podcast today. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, Claudine.
Thank you so much for joining me and congratulations on the publication of this stunning novel. How are you feeling about it?
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Claudine. I must admit, because we're all in lockdown and I was in lockdown when it first came out, I was feeling a little bit sad because I was thinking, all I want to do is have champagnes with all my friends and, you know, I want to be going, woohoo, the book's published and that didn't happen. However, I feel so happy with how it's and relieved with how it's been received. And yeah, I feel really fortunate.
It is truly a stunning novel, as I've said, and I am constantly in awe of the breadth and depth of Australian literary talent. Mm. It seems to me that it's a newly discovered well that's in no danger of running dry anytime soon. This book is set in outback South Australia. Had you always pictured writing a rural crime novel or what they refer to as Australian outback noir?
No, not really. I generally write short stories, and last year I had a book published of my short stories, a collection titled Rural Dreams. Mm. And always in everything I write, the landscape is the lens. So this kind of came about when I was talking with my cousin. We're remembering our days hitchhiking up and down the Stuart Highway, and it was early 90s, late 80s when we used to hitchhike, and it got me thinking about those beautiful landscapes. And I've since been back there, that amazing South Australian. I mean, South Australia is such a fabulous state, and there are it's so diverse, and that outback is really compelling. And I started to think, well, maybe I could write a story kind of inspired a bit by young hitchhikers on that road. So in terms of the well not drying up, yeah, I agree with you. We're so fortunate to live in this country. It's like a gift, the landscape, to writers, isn't it?
I couldn't agree with you more. As I mentioned in my intro, your PhD studies focused on depictions of landscape in Australian literature. Was Cutter's End a natural extension of that, do you think?
That's such a great question. And I actually haven't thought of it until now, but perhaps it is in a way, because in my PhD, I did focus quite a bit on the work of Barbara Bainton, an early white Australian novelist who wrote about the bush and their descriptions of the bush, particularly being lonely and isolated. Leah Purcell, of course, obviously her brilliant take on The Drover's Wife as well. That sort of thing inspired me. So I suppose that, coupled with my love for these landscapes, that sort of almost gothic edge did play a part in Cutter's End. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, fantastic. Before we go any further, for those who haven't read Cutter's End yet, can you tell us what it's all about?
It's about a body that's found on the side of the Stuart Highway, that highway that cuts the nation in two. And this body is found around the same time that two young girls are hitchhiking up and down the Stuart Highway. And what happens is then 30 years later, we find there's a man who is connected to those two hitchhikers, and there's a reinvestigation about who that body was, how it came to be there. And that's the focus for Cutter's End.
So as you said, it was your own experiences of hitchhiking in the 80s and 90s that inspired this story. And I grew up, with the malevolent spectre of Ivan Milat's crimes and along with the abduction of Joanne Lees and the murder of Peter Falconio in 2001. Mm. This is a crime phenomenon ripe with inspiration, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. And that time in particular, that late 80s, the early 90s, when we'd get picked up in cars, it was often by older women, and they were the lifts that we loved the most for obvious reasons. But they would pick us up and they would say to us, haven't you heard about those girls that are missing on the East Coast? And and we sort of had a vague, we were hearing these stories, but of course, later we found out they were the victims of Ivor Milat. And these, I think it was almost an end to a kind of innocence in Australia of youth. And yes, so that end of a national innocence is certainly ripe for right. Hitchhiking stories are famous all over, really, aren't they? Yeah, it's a genre that people keep coming back to, but that fear coupled with perhaps an outback where literally no one can hear you scream is absolutely ripe for storytelling.
So, Margaret, what is it do you think about outback noir that's so appealing for writers and readers?
I do think, as I just said, that vast, the feelings of desolation that can come over, you when you're in places like that. And certainly to Australia, that's a largely urbanised population, those places can seem almost like alienscapes. So we feel out of place. What comes into that, of course, and is probably for a longer conversation, is the notion of white belonging. Do we really belong here? For white Australians can feel completely out of sorts in those places, which, of course, have been inhabited and managed very well for thousands and thousands and thousands of years by Aboriginal Australians. But for the white Australian, it can feel extremely unfamiliar. And there we have the fodder for all crime, really, putting people in unfamiliar places and situations.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, tell me about Detective Sergeant Mark Arete. Where did he come from, or by whom was he inspired?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really fortunate. I've got three sons, teenage sons. I've got a lovely husband. I've had really great boyfriends. I've got two brothers. I've got a great dad who's a great bloke. So I've had really lovely men in my life. And I wanted to write about a man who is a good man. However, like a lot of men, he's kind of drifting and still succeeding. So he gets promoted when he doesn't really need to. Things happen for him because he's a good bloke and he's a good man, and things happen for him where perhaps for women it's a bit harder. So I wanted to create a man where he's in the process of kind of waking up to that. And the strong women around him, whether it be the other detectives, his colleagues or his wife or his school friends, he's kind of coming to understand that perhaps his drifting along, how he's drifted, isn't necessarily a fair thing. Yes.
Yeah. So you explore that element of white male privilege quite well, I think, in Mark. And he was quite an interesting character on a number of levels, flawed, as you said, in different words, as many of these characters are, but he was shackled by his past in many respects. And the fact that he knew two of the witnesses in the old case painted a picture of a man that really struggles with himself on a moral and ethical level. So I wanted to ask you, how difficult was it for you to craft Mark's character and to strike the balance between cop, friend, husband and father?
In actual fact, in the first draft, Claudine, and you will know because you're a writer, it wasn't that difficult at all, because I just wrote it. I just sat down and wrote and didn't think too much and just wrote about it. And it was when, you know, my second draft and third draft, that's where things became a little more tricky. And certainly when it had been contracted to have it published, when the editors would gently say, police don't really do that sort of thing, or have you looked into police procedurals? And that's where kind of the more difficult work began, where I had to actually look at, you know, police cannot change jurisdictions and go to Victoria or New South Wales willy-nilly. You have to have these. So I had to then kind of get into the nitty-gritty. But in terms of the man and the friend, I felt that was relatively smooth, that process, because I do see around me, a lot of men around me, even in my own sons, how things can fall into their laps if they're kind of a certain type, you know. So whereas it might be if I'd had daughters, I don't know. So that part was relatively easy. The police procedural part was more difficult.
Yeah, I can imagine that would be. So contrasted against Mark is this wonderful character of Jagdeep Cow. I'm not sure if that's the way you say it.
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, she's the local senior constable in Cutter's End. Very different to Mark in many respects. And I think she definitely doesn't have it as easy as Mark does. I wanted to ask you whether she was inspired by a real life character.
Yeah, she was actually. So when I first got a job lecturing at La Trobe University, I went to work in the wonderful town of Shepparton, which is incredibly diverse and really vibrant. And, you know, there's so much to so much to like about Shepparton, particularly now I feel really proud of it with how they've handled their COVID situation and their lockdown. But I went there and one of my new colleagues, she was the boss was Jagdeep, and she was this wonderful Sikh woman. And she was the sort of boss that you want when you first turn up at a job, because she was practical. She knew exactly what she was doing. She told me straight what I had to do. And I never felt unsure of myself when I was with her. Her directions were always very clear. She told me what she needed to do and I went and did them, and she told me how I was doing. She didn't stay very long. She was transferred back to Melbourne. But so I didn't get to know her on a personal level, but certainly her essential qualities that I first met in her, I thought, I like you. And I kind of wanted to be a bit more like her because I was kind of unsure and nervous and apologetic, and she was none of those things. Yes. And later on, I actually wrote to her and said, can I use your name, Jagdeep? It's not you, but those qualities I saw for I want them to be in it. She wrote back and said, that would be great. And actually, I'm thinking of becoming a policewoman. I went, what? So that was great.
Mm. Oh, that is fascinating. So I wanted to tell you that I really loved her as a character.
Yeah.
And she was quite inspiring on so many levels. Her dialogue seemed so at odds with what I imagined was her physical appearance. And I think you refer at one stage to the fact that she's wearing a turban. Was that a difficult thing for you to accomplish? And were you worried about any cultural sensitivities in writing her?
So when I was writing my first draft, I wasn't even thinking about getting published, so I didn't mind. I just wrote, whatever. Mm. And it was in the second or third draft that I thought, yes, you know, I could get in trouble here probably for cultural appropriation. I've got to be really mindful of this. I certainly didn't want to be disrespectful or come across as, you know, someone who knew everything about every culture, because I don't. I absolutely don't. And that is why I don't go into that much about her background, about her Sikh culture. I don't go into that much at all. And I didn't, for the Jagdeep that I knew very briefly, I didn't know anything about that. About her either. Mm. So I just wanted her to be her qualities to shine out firstly, and then perhaps maybe in the second or third book. But I always wanted to be respectful to her, and the qualities what I wanted first place. And I really like her too. And lots of readers have said that she's their favorite character. So yeah, I mean, I hope it comes across as respectful, Claudine. I really tried to do that. And I was fortunate that I had this wonderful woman who was in the background of my head, who I liked very much as sort of the benchmark. Yep.
So, Margaret, I think it's fair to say that most of the female characters in this book have little faith in the legal system. Mm. The attitudes towards women as victims back then, you know, we're talking about part of the narrative that was in the 80s and 90s, and the behaviours that impact on their characters is called into sharp relief in the narrative of this story. Do you think much has changed since then?
I would like to say yes, but I don't think so. You know, I was listening to that wonderful Grace Tame and Brittany Higgins, and I don't think so. Our conviction rates for rape are really low still. Our family violence is a national shame. Mm. No, unfortunately, Claudine, I don't think so. I am not I hasten to say I'm not a lawyer or a legal person. I'm not. So I only know what I see in the media and what I read about. But for a woman on the street, you know, walking, I don't think so, unfortunately.
Hmm. Do you think that the legal system is still in victim blame mode?
Well, when I look at the Grace Tame and Brittany Higgins, yes, I would think so. And there's just been a horrible case in the UK where the man got something like 5 months for strangling a woman. I don't understand that. So, yes, I think there is still victim blaming going on. And certainly, you know, the other day I was with my dad. I was talking to my dad, and he said that he saw hitchhikers on the side of the road, a woman hitchhiking on the side of the road. And he said, oh, what's she doing? Silly, silly woman out there. And I said, Dad, why should she be? We kind of had this argument, but there we go. Over my father, who is a lovely, gentle, wonderful man, was still very quick to blame a woman who obviously her car might have broken down. She might have needed a lift. So, yes, unfortunately.
We could talk all day about these, you know, national tragedies that are playing out right before our eyes, but we'll probably leave that for another time.
Yes.
At one point in this story, Mark is horrified by the thought that he might have shoved an old girlfriend against a wall, and he considers himself a man who would never hit a woman, you know, let's be clear. But in many ways, I feel like he fails to see, at least initially, that meant that there are many other ways that women can be brutalized. Is that something you consciously wanted to explore in this novel?
Yes, and again, I'm thinking of those of that narrative, that kind of good bloke kind of persona that we really hold to a high degree, you know, that we is our national kind of stereotype in some ways, you know, the good bloke, the hero, the Anzac, that sort of thing. It's been a very old stereotype, and I did want to explore that. And yes, you're right, I wanted to look at how, you know, this Mark who has sort of drifted along, life's been good, life's been great for him, things have fallen into his lap, and suddenly he's starting to realize that perhaps things aren't as easy as he first sees. So he starts asking his wife, you know, about whether anything as terrible has happened to her. He's shocked about how people speak to his ex-girlfriend, and he's horrified at the thought he might have once shoved his ex-girlfriend when he'd been drunk. All of these things I think are plausible. All of these things, I imagine there are many, many men who think like this. My own sons, my own teenage 17-year-old son is sometimes horrified what I tell him that sometimes teenage girls go through. It's like this naivety or something that they don't see. That's people who I know anyway. But I certainly wanted to put Mark in the process of awakening a little bit, and I hope that's happening.
It was so interesting to me because I think you're right on the money in that respect. Certain men, and my boys would be in exactly the same position, would rarely encounter anything as shocking as, you know, what I fear might be some of the things their sister might have to face.
Yes,
you know,
absolutely.
At some point in the future. And they would be none the wiser. They would have no idea unless it comes knocking on your door. You could go through your entire life without understanding that these are the kinds of things that women face on a day-to-day basis. And it's
absolutely
really.
And that's not to say that your sons and my sons are terrible people or anything like that. It's just how they've, I don't know how they're almost conditioned or how society conditions them, but we have good men, and hopefully with mothers like you, Claudine, and hopefully myself.
And you, of course.
I think our sons will be good people.
Indeed, it is my sincere hope that will be the case. Sarah, how much do you think your own environment, living in regional Victoria as you do, impact or influence your own writing?
Oh, everything. Absolutely everything. I've always lived in the regions. Of course, I went to Melbourne University and I lived in London for a while too. Always and everywhere. So my father was the headmaster of little bush schools where there was, you know, kind of 8 or 10 or 30 kids. So I think I went to 6 or 7 different schools around Victoria. And always it does. And I love rural communities. I love rural life. I love the beautiful landscapes and how diverse our country is. I'm constantly inspired by that. In another world, I would have been a landscape writer, I think, or a nature writer. If I could, I'd be a painter, but I'm not a painter. But everywhere, I would have to say Claudine, I think. Yeah. And because I live here and at the moment I'm looking outside and I can see the beautiful Beechworth Gorge and the Beechworth State Forest, and it's just a joy. I feel very fortunate where I live, and I'm very happy with our choice to live in rural areas.
Fantastic. Well, as I said before we started recording, it's an area that I am familiar with and once spent quite some time in, and so I completely understand you being enamoured with your environment because it certainly is a very inspirational area to live. Margaret, you're an accomplished writer, as mentioned. You've written award-winning plays, and you're also the author of a collection of award-winning stories, which you mentioned before, called Rural Dreams. Given your experiences, do you have any tips for the many aspiring writers out there who listen to this podcast?
Well, one thing that I know that has worked for me, and I must say, you know, I'm 49. It's not like I've been doing this since I was 8, like most writers, is to kind of really free yourself in that first draft. So free yourself from worrying about politics or identities or grammar or even spelling or whatever. Just write that first draft as freely as you can and without restriction, and try not to put pressure on yourself. And I think that really, really helps. It's probably why second books are notoriously difficult to write, or follow-ups rather. But I would say to free yourself when you write, yes, if you can. So to turn off the phones, turn off the things and feel free. I mean, I also handwrite, so I don't know whether that's anything, but that seems to work for me too.
Fantastic. I can't think of the author that I know handwrites all her first drafts, but the name will come to me a little bit later. But that's only the second time I've heard that.
Yeah, I find handwriting it feels to me more authentic for me when I write it. And I like all my scribbles. And I'm a teacher as well. I teach Year 12 English, and I love it when students hand me drafts with scribbles all over and arrows and things. I say, this is what I want. This is the best. You know, this is what I want to see. This is what, this is your, how your brain works.
So, oh, that's fantastic. I wish I was in your Year 12 English class.
Oh, I
think I would have done better.
I'm fantastic. Sure you did very well.
It was okay. Margaret, I feel like we've not quite heard the last of Mark Arete. Will we see him again?
Do you know what, Claudine? You are the first person I've ever told outside of my family. I think I told my mum. But yes, you'll see Mark Arete again. It's confirmed. But yes, it's being written. The second book has been written. And yes, Penguin has taken on, yes,
oh,
the other book.
So exciting.
Yeah, I'm really, but now I've got the, but I'm trying really hard to be free as I did with the first one. And I've got to admit, it's a bit harder. Yeah. So I'll try.
I'm sure it'll be fabulous. I'm so looking forward to that.
Oh, thank you, Claudine.
Margaret, if readers wanted to connect with you or to learn more about you and your work, where can they find you?
Well, there is a website. So I think it's just www.margarethickey.com.au, and I'm always happy to hear about that. My 14-year-old son regulates my website, so he does everything. So if you see some funny things on there or some things that look a bit strange, I didn't write them, he did. He wants me to start paying him $5 a week, but I don't know.
Oh,
I'll
bless.
See. I think I will.
That's very entrepreneurial of him.
Yes, yes, yeah.
Margaret, congratulations on this stunning debut crime novel. I absolutely loved it. I wish you every success with it, and I can't wait to see what Mark gets up to next. Thank you for joining me on Talking Aussie Books.
Thank you so much, Claudine.
Well, that's a wrap, folks. If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave a review on iTunes or drop me a line via my Instagram at Claudine Tennellis or on my webpage, claudinetennellis.com. Thanks for listening. Until next time, happy reading.